Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another episode of In the Eyes of Truth. Back with us is Cameron McGregor. Cameron,
Hey everyone.
don't ask the same questions everyone asks. Let it be. There's always a question in the comments. There's like a bunch of them about relations and things like that. Just let it be. Let it flow. With Cameron, we're going to discuss, first of all, because Cameron is former U.S. Navy. So this is a man that has been out to sea. As opposed to, me, I'm tanks, infantry, and whenever something's burning, it usually I understand it's bad. And if it's 30 hours a tank is burning, there's usually nothing left of a tank. But how is it that let's just begin with this, the Ford. First, let's begin with the goo trail, the brown goo trail of the Ford. 80% of toilets are clogged. What could cause that? Is that sabotage, soft mutiny, people flushing? I've heard that maybe people flushing ropes and t-shirts down, or is that something that could actually happen on its own in a system that big that 80% of toilets would clog up and overflow?
Well, as a preliminary, I'm happy to report I never saw anything like that when I was in service. Thank God. So that's we're off to a good start there. Secondly, let me just repeat what I just said to you offline. I have heard shockingly little, and bear in mind I've been out of the Navy a long time, but I still do have some friends that are in, most of whom I went to the Naval Academy with, not all of whom, but I've heard shockingly little about what's going on over there. I've heard shockingly little about casualties. I've heard shockingly little about the success of Iranian precision strikes against our equipment, against our ships. And I fully expected that Iran would be able to damage, at least damage some of them, if not sink some of them. That's a prediction that I made going into the conflict. I think you and I actually talked about that. But I have heard through the grapevine that morale in the US surface fleet, which is where I was, and I spent my time deploying out of San Diego, and I did deploy to the Persian Gulf, the Arabian Gulf, I guess, from the US perspective in 2000.
It's not Trump Arabian Gulf.
Well, give him time, Seth. Don't say it too loud. In any case, I have heard that morale is extremely low right now across the service. And there are many reasons for that that I think are structural. The first is there is definitely a retention crisis. The surface fleet, you got to remember, as it stands today, in terms of its mission statement of forward deployment of policing the world seas, that largely has been unchanged since the 1980s when we had a 600 ship Navy. Today, we've got less than 200 operational ships. And how many of those are fully capable or overstretched or using older equipment? Probably a lot. So you're talking about a force that's extremely small that's trying to fulfill a mission statement for a massively larger force from the 1980s. So that alone suggests that the strain, the stress on personnel is extreme. It's not heavy. It's not a heavy lift. It's extreme. And so I have heard through the grapevine that that sort of hardship is beginning to manifest in a real problem of morale. Could that have manifested on the Ford or other carriers that have been deployed for months and months and months? Remember that combat effectiveness, they say anecdotally, really starts to drop off at about 6 months. Because at about 6 months, there's only but so much you can take. And bear in mind, and you know this well, being former military as well, you have to rotate people in and out, and you have to do so at a predictable velocity. Otherwise, you're going to have mutinies. It happens. It happens in major wars all the time. So, yeah, it could absolutely be the case that that there is a collapse of morale and that there is a sort of mutiny. And remember that on these carriers, you're talking about a community. It's like a veritable city-state floating around of 5,000 people. So all that is to say, no, I don't know exactly what's going on, but it's circumstantial evidence that things are not good. And then, of course, I've also heard that some of these ships have been damaged. We know that the Iranians have at least said that they have attacked them. Whether or not they've actually done damage, that's another matter. But I'm, as a betting man, I'm betting that they have done some damage.
Yeah, I saw some, well, it's fuzzy pictures, but they're basically infrared of one of the destroyers burning. They
Yes.
said was caught while it was refueling.
Yeah, and at a minimum, just setting that aside too, the Navy has very wisely maintained these carrier strike groups at distance because they are very worried about Iran's capabilities. And obviously, I'm sure you've heard over the last few days, it seems like, and this is something else that I feared going into the conflict, that Iran can reach all the way to Diego Garcia. So have we seen the full payload of what Iran is capable of doing and throwing at us? Maybe not. Maybe not yet. So perhaps in the days to come, we will see something like a carrier or one of the adjacent capital ships be sunk by tech that that we're not prepared for.
Well, let me ask you this. Okay, so the four's been out for what, about 11 months now?
Yeah.
I mean, that's without stopping at any ports or
Yes. Well, I think it had I think it had a bit re it, I think it had a refit. I forget where, because it had some internal plumbing issues, if you recall. So it did have a brief refit. I don't know how long exactly that was, but you're right, more or less, they've been on continuous deployment.
Now that's the Ford. It's a huge piece of equipment. What about the
Yes.
destroyers, the submarines, the escorts? They're all out there just as long, right?
Yes,
So you got
that's
an
right.
Arleigh Burke that's got 350 crew on a much smaller platform that's been out
Yeah.
there for basically 11 months.
Well, they can rotate them in and out. So perhaps it's perhaps they're some of the smaller ships that are doing that, putting different ones on station. But nonetheless, you're talking about a very, very prolonged deployment, a lot of stress, and probably a very complex mission set at the moment because you're dealing with potentially drones, you're dealing with precision strike weapons. And then, of course, remember, you've got to have all these ships that are on station just to protect the carrier in general. So maybe they're participating in other, they're detaching and doing other things and then coming back into the strike group. So I can only imagine how harrowing it is right now. And more than anything, Stas, what's the strategy? When are they coming back?
4 days.
What's the end state? Nobody
Four
knows.
days.
Yeah, right.
4 days is of 25 days ago.
Right.
The 4 days ended 21 days ago, and we're
That
still
kills
going.
morale, as
Oh,
you
yeah.
know, that absolutely cripples morale. It's one thing to push the limit, but if these guys are out there just floating around and they have no idea when they're going to come home, that's when you start to see discomfort and revolt among the ranks.
Well, let me ask you this. This 30-hour fire in the laundromat. I mean, 30 hours to put out a fire, 600 bunks, or an area for 600 bunks, damaged. Is that something that's possible for a localized fire to go that big that takes 30 hours to put it out? Or is that something that may be caused by a direct hit, or a drone hit?
I never saw anything like that in the Navy. I never heard of anything like that. But I will say a couple things. It's a bit suspicious to be sure. But if these ships are undermanned, if the personnel are not properly trained to put out fires, depending on how severe they are, yeah, things can get out of control very quickly. So maybe it is internal. Maybe it has nothing to do with a strike from afar. It's hard to imagine that, but again, we're at optimal manning. We know that we don't have sufficient personnel in a lot of these ships. That's probably true on the carrier as well. How well trained are these? And remember, if you go back 10 years, I believe it was in 2017, in a very, I want to say, a 6 month period, we had a lot of accidents at sea. There are many reasons for that, one of which is probably poor training. So that could actually factor into this more decisively than people think as well. Remember, these guys are sort of thrown into the mix. There's nobody in the administrative chain of command, never mind the operational chain of command, that seems to much care about their sustainability. It's just fulfilling these mandates. It's getting, getting the promotions and so forth from the higher ups. So they're exhausted, they're forward deployed, they're probably, at their wit's end, and then maybe they're not being trained properly either.
Yeah, so what are you trying to say is the admirals, just like the generals, don't really give a damn about their soldiers. They give a damn about their big billion-dollar career or million-dollar career afterwards.
If they do care, and this well, the Navy is a very complex, multi-layered organization. If people do care, there's such a cog in the machine that they just are a small cog in the machine. They can't stop it anyway. So that's part of the problem here as well. It's like a gigantic ship. It's very difficult to tilt it, one
Right,
direction or
right.
another, particularly once inertia starts. But look, these things are very concerning because at a minimum, it suggests that the operational security of our forces is potentially very vulnerable. And I suspect we're going to find out in the days ahead, especially as these Marines, if they are used the way we think they're
Oh,
used,
good
we're
Lord.
going to see real collateral damage because of a negligence at the top of the U.S. military. Mind you, the top of the U.S. military, not necessarily the White House, not the elected government, but the U.S. military itself. And I emphasize that because right now it's very easy to pile on the president. Obviously, there's questions about his competency, his frame of mind, these kinds of things we'll talk about in a moment. But the military has escaped accountability too, right?
Oh,
It is
yeah.
incumbent on the services to tell the president what's possible, what's not possible. And if you read books like Dereliction of Duty, which was written by H.R. McMaster, what that tends to suggest is the president, more often than not, will listen to the senior advisors inside the U.S. military.
Yep,
So this
yep.
is not just a case of Dr. Strangelove in the White House. It's also a failure, I think, of multiple levels of government of governance to include the U.S. military.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm not exactly expecting to see any single general or admiral resign. Maybe one, but I don't think so. An unfortunate part, resign in protest, I mean.
Well, we'll see. I mean, Joe Kent's resignation recently, I think, is a good sign.
It is.
There is unrest in the ranks. I think that's true. It's very difficult to quantify that. Is that mirrored, or rather, is that spreading to the higher ups? It's hard to say. I mean, as you know, there's a lot of collateral damage if you publicly rebuke, the chain of command,
Oh, yeah.
resign, that type of thing. But it's not possible if this thing goes completely awry and lots of people get killed. Now, some will say it's already happened. I
Oh,
don't
it
know. We'll
has.
find out.
I mean, the casualty rates are obviously, in my best guesstimate, probably 10 times what they're admitting to, which
Well,
still is
here's
really
my
not that
question.
much if you think about it, but still.
Well, here's my question, and I know that you're well versed in this too. We have bases strewn across the Middle East. They're getting pummeled. They're being pulverized right now. We've lost our air defenses. We've lost a lot of our radar systems. What's happened with them? We don't exactly have a mobile force on the ground that can go rescue these guys.
No.
So what is to become of them? I mean, you're watching a kind of colonial expedition get completely overwhelmed along the lines, I would say, of something like Isandlwana, that the British faced in the 19th century. It's kind of a little bighorn event in that sense. And in terms of the media, it's silence. So who knows what's going on? And to your point, there's thousands of personnel over there,
Oh,
maybe
yeah.
more than that. So how many of those guys are being killed as
Well,
we speak, and it's just not being publicized?
tens of thousands. Let's begin with that. Second of all, a lot of those guys that were supposedly moved out, they're just moved to hotels.
Yes.
And they filmed from those hotels. They're stupid enough to do that. But and post it.
Yeah.
But what I've been told, and I as a combat officer, for a land warfare combat officer, I'm just in shock when I heard this. Those big bases, the Air Force and Naval bases, they don't have bunkers. They never built bunkers
Yep.
because they were A, so sure there wasn't going to be a war. If it's going to be, it's going to be something short. And B, they're so sure the air defense systems would protect them no matter what, they never built bunkers. Well, no air defense system ever protects you 100%. Sorry, but that's reality. Anything can be overloaded. And two, from what I've gotten from a couple sources, they're out of ammo, or they're been destroyed, and now there's panic because right now the Iranians are destroying the infrastructure and the tech on there, but sooner or later they're going to turn on to the personnel, and there's no place to hide.
Yes. Well, what you say about Bahrain is absolutely true. So I have been to Bahrain, and that base has always been very vulnerable. In fact, last summer when that 12-day war happened, I asked a friend of mine who was still on active duty at the time exactly how vulnerable Bahrain is. And he said, look, the locals here, could attack it and destroy it, never mind Iran using precision strike. And what I've been told subsequent to the beginning of the war this time is that, yeah, they've evacuated a lot of person U.S. personnel who are just sitting in hotels. And in some cases, I've heard the hotels are being shelled.
Oh
So,
yeah. Because
yeah, I
Iranian
mean, it's massive.
human intelligence, they picked it up on. When military staffs are operating a hotel, it becomes a military target. But it's not just Bahrain. That's Fifth Fleet. In Saudi Arabia is the same thing. Prince Sultan and other bases in Qatar,
Yes.
they never built bunkers. Which to me is like, wait, we stopped in a place where we could get shelled. We don't have a bunker. Start digging. But they never built. I mean, in 30 years, they've been there since the early 1990s, and they never built bunkers.
Yeah. Well, and if the effectiveness of the Iranian, anti-air capability is to be believed, and they're shooting our aircraft down. That's happening. Not just refuelers either, as we know. That means we don't control the skies. So how are we going to rescue these people? We don't have that mobile reaction force on the ground. It's going to be difficult to land anywhere. I mean, that's why this whole operation, people don't seem to understand, Stas, and I know that you do well, that this is now a very complex operation just to withdraw,
Oh,
just
yeah.
to get forces out. And what seems to be happening right now is that there seem to be multiple bastardized plans in response to what Iran has done happening at the same time rather than one exit strategy. Operation seize control of the straits, maybe some kind of operation to rescue these guys. And then you've got the ongoing air bombardment at the same time, the demining operations. I mean, it's a mess. It is a total mess.
Well, you could get these guys out by, but you'd have to do it in small convoys to keep them from being a big target. But then where do you go? You go east, I mean, you go west to Jordan, and what, into Israel with ports that are going to get bombed. Maybe if you could really sweet talk the Egyptians, they'll let you go through Egypt. Or maybe if you really sweet talk the Islamic jihadists in Syria, that seem to be America's best friends these days. They might let you get into Turkey, but either way, you've got to move a lot of people up to 30, 40,000. Now, in Iraq, the Iraqi militias have allowed the Spanish, the Poles, and other nations to get the hell out. Their contingents of Swedes get on a plane, get out. I'm not sure whether what's going to happen with the Americans. I mean, you've seen the videos. The green sector, the green zone is burning. They get hit constantly. They've got to be running out of ammo and food by now. I mean, 25 days in.
What's happening piecemeal is the total destruction of the U.S. Middle Eastern Empire. That's what's happening. And those bases are going to be completely destroyed. And if we don't have a solid plan in the near future to get these personnel out, I've heard that there's less than 25,000 of them. It's hard to know what that number is. But if we don't come up with a solid plan soon and use these exit points, as you point out, some of which flow through the Red Sea, which again, the Houthis have not engaged yet. That's coming, I suspect.
I think they
So,
have. There's been a ship that was burning that they said the Houthis hit. I don't know. Maybe they didn't. And apparently they've declared that they're now engaged yesterday.
yeah. So, I mean, it's if it hasn't occurred yet, it's coming at any time. So they could be completely shut off. Either way, the empire, as we understand it in the Middle East, the military infrastructure, Bahrain, the naval refitting there, it's over. It's done.
So we'll go back to be prior to 1991, which, if you think about it, for America, actually America, that's probably not a bad thing.
I think I would go back farther. So I think there are multiple levels here. And my guess is you would concur with this. Look, I think at a strategic level, this is the end of the Sykes-Picot Agreement in 1917. I think Arabia is in chaos. I think the Trucial states along the Gulf are finished.
Oh,
I
yeah.
mean, let's face it, they are businesses masquerading as countries as it is. Their legacies of Western imperialism and the British Empire, they will not survive. And I would go a step farther and say, I'm not sure OPEC as structured today will survive.
Oh, yeah.
And these things
Yeah.
obviously are a product, they're sort of franchises of the mid-20th century. This is a compound fracture and a new alliance of sorts, I think, in the background will involve Iran, Turkey, and whatever's left of Arabia in a post-American, post-Israel, post-OPEC Middle East. That's what's coming. And I think who's going to broker the deal is probably the Chinese.
Yeah, Chinese, Russia's in there too. By the way, on the second day, Putin was talking all of these Arabic sheikhs off the ledge. They all want to jump into this war. Like, yeah, that's probably not a good idea. But yeah, the Saudis will probably survive in some form or another. They're big enough. But these Bahrain, Qatar, United Arab Emirates, all these little sheikdoms that are, yeah, I've been in Dubai once. I went to Dubai. I was director in supply chain at Halliburton. And we had a big meeting for the senior directors in Dubai. So we all went down there. And I wanted to, you know me, I like history. I like, ruins. Get in there. So I'm like, I was determined to find old Dubai. I want to see old Dubai. Search the internet, nothing. Get down there, start talking to locals. They start laughing. It's like historic Dubai was a mud brick fort, a small village, and like one or two piers. That's it. That was historic Dubai. It doesn't exist anymore. They just raised it. So everything there, you're right. It's a corporation. So a giant corporation masquerading as a nation, pseudo nation state. That's absolutely dependent on technology to keep it alive. It's most of them are one trick ponies. Gas or oil and desalination plants, and that's it. Without
And
that, they don't exist.
a lot of the folks who live and work in the traditional states, these states like Qatar, they're foreigners anyway.
Right.
They're not even locals. They're not even organic. Look, one way to look at what has happened, and I do think to some degree it frames the mindset of the White House as well, is that you have artificial states and structures against civilization states.
Right.
Iran is a civilization state, just like Russia. You could make the argument, right, that Ukraine was never real, that it's bastardized. I know that
Oh,
you've
yeah.
made that case. Look, the traditional states are artificial, and so is that state created in 1948. It's not a real state like Iran. And so, as artificial states combat real civilization states, the real civilization states tend to win those battles. And that is the way that I see this conflict. The other thing I'll say is this: th there is an Arab proverb that I think is very apropos, and it goes something like this: me against my brother, me and my brother against my cousin, me and my
Yeah.
brother and my cousin against the world. What is happening is not this sort of isolated conflict between Iran and Israel with the United States operating in the background. That's what the White House wanted to believe. I'm sure that that's what the Israelis hope for. What's happening now, I think, is a house of Islam against this sort of American Zionist axis. And
Right.
that is to say a couple things. One is that this strike against Iran is not an isolation from the genocide in Gaza. And
Right.
so what has become, I think, this sort of villainized, ostracized Ayatollah regime is now the cause célèbre across the Islamic world. And so I think on the Arab street level, even in places like Saudi Arabia, you're going to see a shift, if you haven't already, in public opinion in support of Iran to get the United
Yeah.
States and the state of Israel, well, I should say America, out of the Middle East and to neutralize the state of Israel. Completely. What exactly that looks like, I don't know, but I do think at a minimum it means the collapse of Netanyahu's government, at a minimum.
It was a funny part is too, a lot of those Arab states were like, look, if as long as Israel can live like a normal state, we'll deal with it fine, whatever.
Course.
They're there. But they can't. They just declare, what did Shmulich just declare today? Oh, we're gonna annex southern Lebanon.
Yes.
There's no longer even a buffer zone. We're just gonna annex it and build our villages there and our towns and get rid of the locals because we're just murdering them off, driving them off or murdering them
My
off.
question is, when does Egypt enter into the conflict? Because we know they've got about 50,000 troops inside Sinai. They remain the most powerful Arab military. They have a history of fighting wars against Israel. Yeah, it's been a long time since the Yom Kippur War, but inflation is powerful inside of Egypt. It's having an impact. I know that Sisi is under pressure, and everybody, especially the Israelis in the United States, assume that they're just on the take. But I have reason to believe that could change it at any moment. If it does, then you're talking about another front that I don't think the Israelis are prepared to deal with at all. So I don't see how you exit this conflict, which is a compound fracture,
Oh, yeah.
in which the Israelis are isolated from the rest of the world outside of us, and we're increasingly being pushed out of the region. I just don't see how you exit this conflict without the state of Israel being destroyed as structured. I don't see how it happens.
Well, I mean, the level of arrogance, because in a way, the religious fanatics. Because Jewish Zionists are also heretics to traditional Zion to traditional Judaism, just like Christian Zionists are heretics to Christianity. No other way to put it. But they and I talked to a Jewish scholar. I did an interview with him, and he's like he's talking about how it came out to be, and he's saying they just like the Christian Zionists, they think they can push the hand of God. And if things get bad enough, because they feel that they're chosen, even though that in traditional Judaism they can't come back to the Holy Land until the Messiah comes, and because they're punished, but they've decided, we'll skip standing in a corner and we're just gonna go jump in anyways. But they believe that if they can make things bad enough, then God will come in there and wipe everybody out for them.
Yep. Well, look, as we entered into this conflict, what did people say in the United States? They said that the regime in Tehran was irrational, that it was a theologically driven regime, that it was incapable of making strategic calculations, and ultimately it was a kind of rogue lunatic state. These are talking points that people like the Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, made. What we've actually discovered is that no, it's actually the regime in Israel that is thinking in terms of eschatology, that they have, it appears, no regard for a strategic framework for limited military objectives in their own interests, and that they see these terms in Armageddon-like framing. So I think they have started a conflict that will mean the end of Israel as we understand it. Again, I it's dangerous to speculate exactly what that means. But look, Iran has demonstrated a few things. The first is that they can utterly pummel the state of Israel inside and out. I mean, just as many Iranian officials have been murdered and assassinated, well, now that's starting to happen on the Israeli side. Just as Iran's nuclear sites have been targeted, well, now Dimona is being targeted as well. So it strikes me that Iran is capable of getting control of this escalatory spiral. And it seems to me that on the borders adjacent to Israel, that's really where they're going to be overwhelmed and annihilated. I think that's the next stage of the conflict.
No, you're being unfair. It's not just Israel that's driven by religious fanatics. Look at the White House. I mean, look at people like with Paula White, head of the faith office, and I see the angels coming, 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 coming. This woman made a video. I've got a clip of it on my phone, where she flat out says, Trump is the anointed of God, and to raise your hand against Trump is like to raise your hand against God. And she and reiterate, and she's not the only one. I mean, if she's just a one lone whack job, that'd be one thing. But she's surrounded by echelons of the same type of Zionist preachers, and the word coming in, several brigade commanders and at least one 3-star general that came in. They start their staff meeting with, "Don't worry, if we're all going to die, we die for Trump, who's going to bring back Jesus."
Yes. Well, there is a certain eschatological backdrop in the United States as well. Although, from my vantage point, and I think sadly, there is circumstantial evidence, and I'm going to choose my language very carefully here. But yesterday, as you know, the president put out a tweet regarding negotiations and a sort of temporary cessation of hostilities in the Middle East. Now, I think that the president was misleading. I don't think he was telling the truth, and I think that that is verifiable. However, what's interesting is that about 5 minutes before the president tweeted that out, which if I'm not sure if your audience knows this, but
Oh,
markets in the United States rallied, oil prices fell substantially. I mean, very significantly. I'm an investor and I am invested in oil as well. I began that process a few weeks ago. By the way, so did Barron Trump, okay?
Oh, yeah.
Which is noteworthy. But 5 minutes after the president sent that tweet out, which jolted markets, a very sizable bet to the tune of about a $1.2 billion amount was placed on in the futures market of the S&P, and a $150 million bet on the short side of oil was placed at the same time. Now, only but a few people in the world could have known that the president was going to send a tweet out like that. So again, I don't want to overstate the case, but I guess my point is, Shaz, that the White House seems to be operated by a kind of criminal cartel that is monetizing what's happening on the one hand, and on the other hand, is deliberately misleading the public about what's going on over there, and maybe doesn't even understand themselves the quagmire that they have just launched the United States into. That could be the case as well.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, look, this is the same president that put out the Trump coin, the Milani coin, which
Yes.
sucked up 30 billion, 30 with a B, billion dollars off of
Yes.
MAGA, half of which can barely afford to make ends meet. Because he's told him, "Yo, we're gonna be buy my Trump coin, and we'll all be part of one big happy family." Like, seriously?
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
It's
look,
so.
who is the audience for the president? The audience, obviously, on the one hand, is MAGA, but it's also Wall Street. And,
Absolutely, it's Wall Street.
Trump consistently seems to virtue signal in one way, shape, or form to the bankers on Wall Street. He's gotten enormously rich since he's been president in the fall of 24. So we're dealing with a level of flagrant corruption. It seems circumstantial evidence suggests that I think is unprecedented in the history of the United States. Now, here's what's very alarming. Nobody much cares right now in the United States, and they will not care until we go into a recession. Now, I think we are on the verge of going into a recession. If you go back 30 years, a precondition of sorts for a recession is a spike in the price of oil. The president of the United States, by starting this war in the Middle East, has triggered a daisy chain of an energy crisis. That's going to affect Americans. That's one. The other is that we have a banking crisis of sorts that has started in the shadow banks in the United States. BlackRock, in particular, as I'm sure you probably know, maybe you don't, they've had to halt or turn off withdrawals from some of their major funds.
I saw that. Just one article and then nothing else after that.
Right. But they're not the Lone Rangers. There's problems in Apollo and KKR. I mean, it is a $2 trillion size market that's on fire. And remember that if you go back to 2022, when the Russians went into Ukraine during this special military operation, officially they said that there's about $2 trillion in derivatives that are priced in the global energy markets. It's at least that higher today. That's also on fire. So this is a compound break that's almost certainly going to send the United States into recession, and the president's not going to escape blame for that.
Yeah, that's exactly. And I don't think a lot of people still understand that. I mean, tariff his tariff policies were atrocious. I mean, there is application for tariffs in economics, not like that. That's just the just that's an, another tax on the consumer. And most of the consumers, I guess, were too dumb to figure it out until they got hit so hard that they had to figure it out. Because people
Well,
are warning.
here's another component, and I know this is right up your wheelhouse, being a master of supply chains as you are, but because we have a global energy crisis and prices are rising, that means that energy, which is priced in dollars for the most part, that means you're going to have to sell dollars so that you can raise more funds to actually pay for energy. It also likely means, and I think Iran has played this correctly, that the petrodollar as structured is over as well, because it's just too cost prohibitive to continue to denominate energy costs in dollars. That means more de-dollarization. And that means that less foreigners are going to buy our debt, less foreigners are going to buy US stocks and bonds. That means the twin deficits that we already have are going to blow up. And that means likely at some point a serious financial crisis. Now, I happen to think we're already in it, Stas, but the reality is that however you want to spin this, we have accelerated the de-dollarization and the destruction of the American monetary empire on top of destroying the Middle Eastern empire. So, what a disaster this entire thing has been. But the American people don't know it yet. They're going to find out. I just think it's going to take a few more months.
U.S. is already in that sovereign debt crisis. It's just spinning around the edges of the rim, but it's still getting sucked in because there's no money to pay to service the loan, not to service the debt and get rid of the debt, but service the interest you have to borrow. And once you get in that, it's like those people. I'm sure you've seen people that have a stack of credit cards that thick because they're moving the balance from one credit card to the other, but they're still charging on top of that. So, and they're earning, they're still getting charged percentage. So sooner or later, you just run out of credit cards that you can move debt around to. And everything else is filled up because they're still spending. It's the same thing. I mean, it's absolutely the same thing. And you're right. I haven't been in the U.S. since 2018. You're in there right now, and I'm watching the videos. I'm reading some of the articles. Young people can't afford houses. They can't afford cars. They can't afford anything.
Well, the situation economically for the masses is it's just very fragile. It's paycheck to paycheck. We know that. But what I have concluded over the last few weeks, and I have always been somewhat suspicious of Donald Trump. I'm not sure that he was ever an above board businessman. There's no question that he is a sort of marketing guru. That is a master of self-promotion, but I never saw any real executive talent or substance there. But I think what we're dealing with may be worse. This may be Donald Trump may be America's bad empire, emperor. He may be a sort of corrupt Caesar on par with Nero, and he may have a similar end. I mean, I do not think it is outside the realm of possibility. And in fact, I did an interview late last year in which I said the same thing. I think if this gets completely out of control in a public and unignorable fashion in the United States, I could see the 25th Amendment triggered against against the president. Remember, Section 4 is for incapacity. We've never seen that triggered. That could happen. That could happen. If this operation retake the Straits of Hormuz actually goes forward and we lose a lot of Marines, I think the Secretary of Defense or the Secretary of War, Hegseth, is gone. At a minimum, but that will just start the daisy chain. So we're very close to something like that happening. But I just want to emphasize again, I think that the president, this is not just about corruption. This is not just about sort of executive incompetence. This may be a personality type that's sort of our version of Nero. That could be the case.
Look, in that case, there's two things we need to look forward to that are going to be absolute signs. One, if he makes all the wives of all the senators become whores to pay off the debt. I'm not gonna go down that road any further whether they'd like that or not. That's up to anybody listening to decide. And Nancy Graham will be there just because he's he'll be there just for fun, volunteering.
Of course, of course. Well, you did see Lindsey Graham's comment before we went in, right? I've got it right here. He tweeted out, I mean, again, this is to some degree how people in Washington think. He said Venezuela and Iran have 31% of the world's oil reserves. We, the United States, we're going to have a partnership with 31% of the known reserves. This is China's nightmare. This is a good investment. Insanity, a total inversion of what's happening. But Shaz, I get the sense that there's still a lot of people, not just in the White House either, but in the US government that think that way. And here's what's very alarming. Even if President Trump is removed, that's not going to fix anything. We have an entire structure of government, and this is where I've used the term succession, that is systemically broken. We mentioned the Pentagon earlier. There's obviously failure, I would say categorical failure inside the intelligence community. All of these various entities of government are culpable in this disaster. and are, I think, systemically corrupt. So if the president goes down, if he's forced to resign or he simply resigns, that's just the beginning of a massive purge that's necessary to clean up the United States. I mean, we could be looking at something like what the Russians went through in the 1990s in America. It's possible.
Yeah, but that means there'll be several Americas by the end of that point. Because,
Maybe, maybe.
yeah. And by the way, the second point was, does he have a favorite horse?
Yeah. Well,
Well,
probably does. He probably does.
when it becomes a senator, you know you're screwed. That's the which it may be smarter than some of the senators sitting there right now. Probably would be smarter than some of the senators sitting there right
Probably.
now.
Probably. Certainly less self-harm, that's for damn sure.
You know, this is about 15, 16 years ago, and I was listening to an interview with the guy. So this guy owns a chain of pharmacies, one of which is right near Congress. And of course, he didn't say any names because, you know, he can't, but he said the public would be shocked if they knew how many members of Congress are on anti-dementia medications. They've got scripts for it. It's like
Interesting.
you would be surprised how many members of Congress are just sitting there and they're on cloud nine. They're not here. They're doped up, and yeah, they have no concept of reality. They're totally detached, but they're still serving. I mean, we've seen that on the Supreme Court, where judges are sitting there and just snoring because they're like 90 years old, and they just
Yeah.
won't leave until they're dead. Well, yeah, senators do the same thing. House of Representatives, you got the same thing. You got people that'll sit there until they're literally dropping dead.
Yeah. Well, look, I tend to think in terms of structure. And just as we talked about the framework for the Middle East, which is more or less a shadow of the agreement in 1917, you know, these sort of phony states that were created in the aftermath of the Ottoman Empire. We talked about the OPEC inception in the 1960s and the sort of cartel in Arabia that meets occasionally to set prices and so forth. We talked about, you know, things like the IEA, you know, the International Energy Association, which comes out of the 1970s. These structures are broken, and so is the two-party system in the United States. It's broken, and it was supposed to be fixed by Donald Trump and the MAGA movement. And what we've discovered is that the MAGA movement was a facade. That at a minimum, it was assimilated by a very corrupt system. And maybe it was hijacked by a Nero-like American emperor, so to speak. You know, the emperor has no clothes, and neither does the Senate, neither does the House, et cetera, et cetera. Maybe this is a good thing because it will force the public to really get engaged and to sort of realize the promise of America first. Because remember, Americans, while they haven't been too engaged in the empire overseas, they've opposed it for a long, long time. But now, for the first time in maybe 80 years, the United States is going to suffer consequences for its misbegotten adventures overseas. And I think that means real political consequences this time.
I mean, look, you can tell how much of a Ponzi scheme this is. What did Trump say? You know, we make money when price of oil goes up. Well, he and his clique makes money. The American public loses money. Now, you know, in 2011, as what can be done? In 2011, Russia ran into the point, I just moved back a year before, of gas lines.
Yeah.
Gasoline line. Russia, one of the biggest producers of gasoline or petrol in the world, of diesel in the world, didn't have any. Why?
Yes.
Because all the companies decided, hey, Europe's prices spiked. We're taking it all to Europe and selling there. And there
Yes.
was no control. There was no government control at that point. And you literally had gasoline lines in the country that produces probably more gasoline than anybody else.
Yes.
So what happened? The government steps in, sets certain price ceilings. They were temporary, but they did set price ceilings, and they put export bans. That's it. No more is going out. And then they switched the export bans on and off. Like, for example, the gasoline export ban just went off in January. The diesel export ban is supposed to go off in end of May, so that the farmers will make sure there's enough diesel for the farmers because it's plowing season. Yes. It's time to get out of there and keep the prices from skyrocketing up, because that affects the cost of food and everything else, down the chain, supply chain. U.S. could do that, could quite easily do that and save the public a lot of pain. You think Trump's going to do that?
Well, what I think is as follows. We have come out of a world in which you had reliable energy security in the Western world for a long, long time. And as long as you have energy security, as long as you can feed the population, you can shelter the population and protect the population. And protection means a lot of things. It doesn't simply mean from invaders from the South, for example. It also means relatively affordable cost of living. We're now entering into a world in which there's going to be a lot more insecurity. It's going to be hard to anticipate how much insecurity. Look, the shale revolution changed everything in the United States. There's no question about that. But we've had a lot of malinvestment. The energy sector has been neglected. We haven't built sufficient refineries or pipelines. These things can't just be turned on, as you know. They require a sort of whole of government and private sector approach. We're entering a period of time now in which Americans who are already living on edge are going to experience significantly higher energy prices. We're going to have to see how they react, but history suggests that when you test co social cohesion like that, that's when you get a combustible political situation, and that is what I expect to see happen in the United States.
I do too. And Europe's going to hit that. Europe is already beginning to hit that. And
Europe's
Southeast
there.
Asia.
They're there. Europe is there. They have a cost of living crisis already. They've got a bond market crisis already. They've got fiscal deficits, and they don't have a whole lot of answers either. I mean, depending on what states you're looking at, I know the southern European states fare a little bit better, for example, than the West European states do. But states like Germany, for example. But the fact of the matter is that a fraught political landscape meshed with a mass number of migrants that are dependent on government services and subsidies that they can't afford, combined with a cost of living crisis. And now you add surging energy costs everywhere. And they're not surging a little bit, they're surging by, a sort of exponential margin. That means you're going to see governments fall. That's what's coming.
Cameron, but here's the problem that everybody's focusing on the surge in price. But here's the big problem. It's not just a surge in price. It's in availability of energy resources. They're literally, you just took off 20% of the world's oil and gas off the market. To bring to economic exploitation, to bring a new field to economic exploitation, 3 to 5 years. To build a
Minimum.
refinery, 5 years. Th
Minimum.
that's just reality of it.
Yes.
And these, the damages I'm looking at from the photographs, I mean, I haven't been a supply chain director building these things in EPC company I work for. Just the photos I'm looking at from Qatar, and it may be much worse, but I'm thinking
Oh,
a
yeah.
year and a half to 2 years to get them back online.
Minimum.
Maybe much worse.
And we're at the beginning of the conflict. I mean, look, so you got Iran is, I want to say, at South Pars gas field. That's the largest natural gas field in the world. Qatar, as we know, 20% of the global LNG trade, 80% of their cargo previously, until recently, went to Japan, South Korea, China, and Taiwan, right? So that alone cannot be replaced in the short term. You're exactly right. And remember that there's no strategic reserve for natural gas, right? For all kinds of reasons. You have that for petroleum, not for gas. So this is a global energy crisis. And we also haven't even really mentioned fertilizer. So
Oh
a
yeah,
substantial
and
portion of
that, by the
fertilizer.
way, yeah, that was, by the way, my next point was, there will be starvation in Europe this year,
Sure.
N not nationwide, but in the subclasses, the lower classes will be starving. There'll be deaths from starvation.
Yeah. No, look, I mean, to say that the situation is bad is it's an understatement, and it's obviously compounded by the fact that you have layers of bureaucracy. You've got this thing called the European Union. You've got these defective parties which are incapable of rapidly responding to the national interest. This is what people don't seem to understand, is that, again, you look at the United States, this starting this war in Iran is a complex compound fracture, but there's no political organization of scale that exists to rapidly fix it. It's not there. There are a few people that are sane of mind. You know, people like Rand Paul, for example, or Thomas Massie. They don't have a political organization. And the same problem exists in Europe. So you're sort of painting this picture of, yeah, 3 to 5 years, assuming that you rapidly deploy a national strategy to act on those problems. We're not going to see that happen.
Iran, the good thing for Iran is its deep rear is Russia and China. And Russia and China will put Iran back on its feet and rebuild it. Who's going to rebuild the Iranian, I mean the Iranian neighbors? You know, who's going to rebuild Qatar? Who's going to rebuild Bahrain? Who's going to rebuild, well, the Emirates, their infrastructure. I'm not even talking their business infrastructure, just their oil and gas infrastructure. First of all, if they're doing it themselves, they got to suck out a lot of money that they've got to invest in the U.S. out to back to home to start rebuilding all of that. Billions of tens of billions of dollars worth of damage. And they're not going to get any revenue coming in while this is happening.
That's
That's
right.
it. The revenue stream's cut.
And that
Zero.
means their governments are going to fall because it's that revenue that satiates the populations who, in many cases, don't even like them. I mean, we've seen this in Bahrain. The monarchy there is not popular. I have real doubts that the House of Saud is going to survive this because you've got to provide revenue to your populations. If that's disrupted in a meaningful sense, a population that's already sort of exercised because you don't do anything about the tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands being butchered by the Israelis, all of a sudden it all converges down upon you. It's a very simple formula. You got to feed the population, you got to shelter the population, and you got to protect the population. If those mandates are not filled, then you get a Sri Lanka-like collapse. And that is what I think could happen across the Middle East. Iran is the big winner. And you know what's amazing about this, Shaz? I'll just say a few things about this because I don't want to relitigate old territory, but going into the conflict, virtually every Western analyst said that Iran was the disadvantaged power, that it was facing colossal power from the United States and Israel. But the fact of the matter is that if you looked objectively at it, whether you're talking about geography, you're talking about strategic alliances, you mentioned Russia and China, you're talking about tactical advantages. Iran had all of them, and they had one thing in particular that I think people are still missing. Who has the modern military in the contest? Is it the United States? Is it Israel, or is it Iran? No, it's Iran. The warfare has changed. I mean, again, you've seen it firsthand.
Absolutely.
It's not simply that drones can do a lot of damage. It's the entire structure of your military industrial complex. Ours is a 20th century platform. Theirs is a 21st century platform, and they are winning as a result.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So we're going to see. It's going to be very interesting. I think by the end of this decade, there's going to be quite a few different countries on the earth, or quite a few countries that are gone. I mean, look, as you said, Qatar is a it's a business. All these countries are business. At what point do they go, we've got our trillions stashed away. It's going to take or hundreds of billions. It's going to take hundreds of billions to refix this. Screw it. Close shop and leave and go have the best life you could ever have off the money that you've gotten. And the people that are stuck there, well, the government just left. Do with it what you want.
Well, that's what happened to the Rajapaksa regime inside of Sri Lanka. The president resigned via email after being escorted to his yacht, and he left. Look, these things can happen. In the United States during the War of 1812, the president left via carriage. He left the White House, which the Brits then subsequently burned, and he was pelted on his way out of the city, out of Washington, D.C. So, look, these things can absolutely happen, but I would say there's one of two scenarios. Either A, they do what you said, they just sort of pack it up and leave, or B, they call Tehran, and Russia and China by way of Tehran. And that's why I say, whatever the new landscape's going to be, Iran is the big winner in this contest. They will determine what that global energy complex looks like, centered in the Middle East, not the House of Saud. Not the Gulf states. not the state of Israel, not the United States.
You're absolutely right. I think we'll come back to this. Let's give it another 2 weeks, and we see everything's shaping up so quickly. 2 weeks, it could be like previously what a year would be, or half a year.
It's amazing to me. I know it's probably less surprising to you, but it's amazing to me the extent to which people thought that the US military empire had a lot more staying power than it did, or had a sort of a life expectancy that would just go on and on. If you look historically, that's just not the way these things go. Yes, there are powers like, or empires like the Spanish Empire or the Ottoman Empire that just limp along, but in their region, they do so. It's very hard to sustain empires thousands and thousands of miles away.
Oh,
And that's what we've
absolutely.
done. That's what we've done. Now it's up in flames and it's happened in record time.
You're well, and communications are in record time. Everything's hyper. And I've said this on Russian television, other people, and they all look at me like I'm crazy. Oh no, it'll take damage, but it'll last. No, gentlemen, things have changed. I think they're now just starting to realize just how much things have changed.
Well, here's my question. I guess the parting question for you, and we can revisit that, revisit this in a couple of weeks or months or what have you. But
2 weeks, I think, would be a good revisit.
people in the United States are playing geopolitical chess in their minds. This is what you see on Twitter. It's always about the sort of tripartite world, the Chinese, the Russians, America. The impression that I get is that the Russians and the Chinese do not believe we acted as stupidly as we have, that they are confounded by the actions that we've taken. And I think they fear this sort of lunatic sitting in the White House. What I don't see is a sort of opportunistic sentiment yet, anyway, in the Russians and the Chinese to jump into this at all. They're just sort of saying, okay, I want to contain the damage and avoid this rogue state called the United States slash Israel. That's the sense I get.
Russia is on both sides of that fence. On the one hand, we want to contain this and we want to contain the damage. On the other hand, Russia is actively helping Iran. Of course,
Yes.
nobody admits it. I mean, Russian drones, straight up. Zelensky was crying about that. Yes, Russia is active. China was a lot more standoffish. But I think China is now taking a good look at it and going, I think these guys are going to win. So
Yes.
that standoffishness is going away very quickly. They're getting more hands on.
Yeah.
Now, will that mean that China is going to go after Taiwan? Maybe. Maybe it's that time. Why wait? Why wait till the Americans pump in more equipment into Taiwan?
Well,
U.S.
we'll see.
Navy's down. Go for it.
Yeah, I mean, look, the Chinese are a merchant power. They really are.
They always
And
were.
I think they're shocked by this because they were not actively trying to sabotage the petrodollar.
No,
They
they
were not
weren't.
trying to change the Eurodollar system. But I think what's happening is that they've been left with no choice. And I think for the Russians, supporting Iran was always on the table. But I think equally they're shocked that we have committed such a blunder, because that's what it is. It is a catastrophic blunder that the history books will retell with interest, because it's just such a disaster. I mean, my God.
But the U.S. is not alone. Look at India. Modi screwed the pooch in so many ways at such bad timing. He betrays Russia. He betrays BRICS in general. He betrays Iran. Puts everything on Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia's gone. I mean,
Yeah.
that's it. You're not getting that oil. And Modi is left. Well, he's got his little medal that he got at the Knesset.
Yeah, that's true. That's
So
true.
you can
And
hold on to that.
India is in a precarious situation, to be sure. But we'll have to see how it shakes out. I just it is a question of when do Western populations and specifically Americans wake up to sort of cry uncle? Because if and until that happens, this is going to get worse and worse. I mean, we're on the escalatory ladder. I do not see the president affecting a swift withdrawal from this. And as we said at the beginning, in this context, even a swift withdrawal, which is the right move, accept defeat, accept the mistakes you've made, and get out, even that is extremely complicated.
And the East Asian stock markets are collapsing today. It's only a matter of time before that catches up with Wall Street. I mean, the
Absolutely.
reality is what the reality is.
Yeah,
So we'll
that's
see.
right. That's
Cameron,
right.
let's come back 2 weeks from now. I think there's going to be more than enough new insight. Or maybe next week, or maybe we won't be here. Who the hell knows? You know what the I'll end with you know what the sad joke of the 70s and the 80s in the US was?
No.
What do you want to be if you grow up?
That's right.
So, and we're back to that. We're now back to that. We've got a bunch of old men who are psychotic, out of touch with reality, and maybe leading us into a world war. I mean, a nuclear world war.
Well, Einstein said it best, didn't he? The difference between genius and stupidity is that genius has its limits.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm not putting any bets on stupidity.
That's right.
Everybody, thank you. Thank you very much for joining us. We will be back. Cameron will be back. And we will discuss hopefully a peace deal, but I've got big doubts on that one. So we'll see where we're at in 2 weeks or in a week.
Talk
Thank you,
soon.
everyone. Thanks, Cameron. Cameron, by the way, before I forget, where can the
Yeah.
people find you?
Oh, yeah. So you can find me on YouTube. I'm at Neo-Masculinity, or just type my name in, Cameron McGregor, YouTube. You'll find me there. And then on Substack as well. That's Men in the City Substack. Those are the two best places.
Excellent, excellent.